You walk into a modern wellness shop today, or maybe one of those upscale smoke
Right,
shops.
the ones that look more like Silicon Valley tech boutiques now.
Yeah, exactly. They're so sleek. And when you go in there is this distinct expectation of, I guess, commercial predictability. Like everything is barcoded. You see the neatly packaged gummies, the sleek little vape cartridges, the meticulously branded tinctures.
It's all very clinical.
Right. You look at a label, it tells you exactly what's inside, and you just sort of assume a very linear, modern regulatory process. Put it there.
You trust the packaging.
Exactly. But then you stumble across this product claiming to be an ancient dream flower, and suddenly the packaging is like covered in hieroglyphs and stylized pharaohs.
It completely breaks that sterile modern aesthetic.
It really does. It promises this gentle euphoria, lucid dreams, an authentic connection to Egyptian mysticism. And you're just standing there looking at ancient cosmology, sharing shelf space with like bubblegum flavored e-liquids and synthetic Delta 8 extracts.
It creates a really fascinating cognitive dissonance, honestly,
Yeah.
because we are so accustomed to the idea that if something is in a blister pack or a vape pen, its pharmacology is fully understood.
Right, we assume it's safe.
We assume it's safe, and we assume its historical claims are just, harmless marketing. But the product you're describing, the Blue Lotus or Nymphaea caerulea, is arguably the ultimate botanical enigma of the modern market.
Which is wild to think about.
It is. I mean, we've taken a plant that literally shaped the theology of an entire ancient civilization, and we've reduced it to an unregulated, highly misunderstood impulse buy.
Which is exactly what we are exploring today. We are pulling from this incredibly comprehensive investigative piece that was just published in the OOTW Journal.
It's a fantastic piece of journalism.
Really in depth. And the goal here isn't just to talk about, a pretty water lily. We need to separate the 3,000-year-old empirical pharmacology from the modern wellness marketing.
Because the gap between those two things is massive.
Huge. We are going to map out precisely what this plant actually does to the human brain. We'll look at why the modern label of natural psychedelic is, well, it's scientifically bankrupt.
Completely
Yeah.
bankrupt.
And we'll uncover the surprising and honestly sometimes severe dangers lurking inside those stylized vape cartridges you see online and in stores.
Okay, let's unpack this. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the way we handle the Blue Lotus today reveals a massive blind spot in our culture.
How so?
Well, we have this overwhelming desire for easily consumable consciousness hacking. We want a tea bag that delivers a mystical experience in 15 minutes.
Right, the drive-through enlightenment model.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that modern lens completely blinds us to the deeply complex, highly specific ways ancient cultures actually formulated and utilized these botanicals. To understand what the Blue Lotus really is, we have to look at how the ancient Egyptians engineered it.
So the OOTW Journal investigation actually starts right there, pointing out a crucial taxonomic detail. Like we call it the blue lotus, but botanically speaking, Nymphaea caerulea is a water lily.
Right, it's not a true lotus.
It's not. And in ancient Egypt, this wasn't merely decorative landscaping along the Nile. The archaeological record shows this plant was effectively a cosmology in petal form.
Yeah, the biology of the plant completely dictated its theology. I mean, if you observe Nymphaea caerulea in its natural habitat, it exhibits this striking circadian behavior.
The way it moves with the sun.
Yes. The vivid blue and gold flower physically opens its petals at dawn. It tracks the sun across the sky. And then, as dusk approaches, it closes back up.
And it doesn't just close, right? It physically moves.
Right. The entire flower physically retracts and sinks below the surface of the water. It just vanishes into the darkness of the river.
That is so cinematic.
And then the following morning, it emerges in the water and blooms all over again.
So imagine you're living in an agrarian society, right? Your entire life is completely governed by the cyclical flooding of the Nile and the daily transit of the sun.
Your whole world is cycles.
Yeah. The Egyptians built their entire civilization around this concept of Mat cosmic order, the daily journey of the sun god Ra, the soul's resurrection. They look at the river and they see this plant performing a literal biological mirror of their most profound religious truths.
It's like nature built a living, breathing metaphor for resurrection right into the Nile.
Exactly. It dives into the primordial waters every night and resurrects with the sun every morning, which completely explains its absolute ubiquity in their art and architecture.
It's everywhere. For over three millennia, the Blue Lotus isn't just featured in their art, It is a structural pillar of their iconography.
Like the temples.
Yeah, the massive stone columns of the Temple of Karnak. They're literally carved to resemble bumbled lotus stalks. It's painted vividly on the walls of tombs in the Valley of the Kings.
You find it woven throughout the Book of the Dead, too.
Right, and other sacred funerary texts where it's acting as a physical conduit for the journey of the soul.
The sheer physical presence of it in these tombs is just staggering. I mean, when Howard Carter finally breached the sealed tomb of King Tutankhamun in 1922.
What a moment that must have been.
Unbelievable. He moves past the gold chariots, past the famous death mask, and he found actual physical blue lotus petals.
Still intact.
Still there. They were meticulously woven into these floral collars and scattered directly on the mummified body of the boy king.
Wow.
But, you know, this raises a mechanical question for me. Like, if it was just a symbol, because we put lilies on graves today as a symbol of mourning, right?
Sure, but we don't eat them.
Exactly. We don't ingest them. But the OOTW Journal highlights something really different about the Egyptian artifacts.
The banquet scenes.
Yes, the banquet scenes. These secular or semi-religious festival paintings. The guests aren't just looking at the flowers.
No, they are highly interactive with them.
They are consistently depicted holding the blue lotus directly to their faces, inhaling deeply, or having the flowers draped over these huge vessels of wine.
Right. And because of that, the scholarly consensus has really shifted. We've moved away from viewing this as mere decoration.
To recognizing it as what?
As a ritual psychoactive sacrament. But, you know, making that transition from viewing the lotus as a mere symbol to a functional pharmacological tool, it requires us to shed our modern categorizations.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we enforce really hard boundaries today, don't we? We have pharmacies for medicine.
Right.
We have churches for spiritual practice. And we have bars for intoxication.
That's a good point. They're completely separate spheres for us.
Exactly. But in antiquity, those boundaries simply did not exist. Altering your consciousness was an inherently religious act, a medical intervention, and a social ritual, all simultaneously.
So if they were using it as a functional sacrament to ease the soul's passage, whether that was during a living festival or in funerary rites, how were they actually consuming it? Because throwing some petals in hot water just seems too weak to induce a genuinely altered state.
And that points to the highly sophisticated empirical science they developed. The historical and chemical evidence strongly suggests the Egyptians understood solubility far better than most modern tea drinkers.
Wait, really? They understood solubility?
Absolutely. They weren't just making aqueous extracts like a simple tea. They utilized lipid and alcohol extraction.
Okay, break that down for us.
So the leading theory is that they created a concentrated oil infusion from the fresh flowers first. They used a lipid and oil or fat to pull the alkaloids out of the plant material.
Because the active compounds bind to fats.
Precisely. And then they steeped that alkaloid-rich oil, or the macerated flowers themselves, directly into wine.
That is wild. So they were utilizing dual solvent extraction thousands of years ago.
Yes. The alcohol in the wine and the lidges in the oil were working together to pull out the psychoactive compounds that water simply cannot touch.
It's a level of pharmaceutical intuition that completely upends the idea of, you know, primitive medicine.
It was deliberate, highly engineered pharmacology. I mean, they understood the mechanics of the plant deeply enough to isolate its specific effects.
Which brings us to a massive contradiction.
The modern market.
Right. The exact same flower that required complex oil-to-wine extraction to achieve a sacred ritualistic state for a pharaoh is currently being sold in disposable vape pens at strip malls to teenagers seeking lucid dreams.
It's absurd when you really look at it.
It is. And to understand the gap between those two realities, we need to completely dissect the chemistry. We need to look at the brain.
Absolutely.
The OOTW Journal is highly critical of how the modern wellness industry markets the Blue Lotus. You see it everywhere online. The buzzwords are always natural, psychedelic, legal, hallucinogen, ancient trip.
And that marketing is biologically illiterate. Just completely false.
Tell us why.
Well, the term psychedelic is currently experiencing this huge commercial renaissance, right? And vendors will attach it to anything remotely mind-altering just to drive sales.
It's a great buzzword.
It is. But pharmacology requires precision. Blue Lotus is absolutely not a classic psychedelic.
Mm.
It completely lacks the foundational molecular structures required to induce that specific
sense. Okay, so by classic psychedelic, we are talking about tryptamines and phenethylamines, right?
Exactly. Molecules like psilocybin and DMT or LSD, they are structurally very similar to serotonin.
The neurotransmitter.
Right. And because of that structural mimicry, They act as agonists at a very specific receptor site in the human brain, the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
Okay, so they fit into that specific lock in the brain.
Precisely. When you introduce a classic psychedelic, it binds tightly to 5-HT2A. And this binding initiates a massive cascade of neurological changes, the most significant of which is the disruption of the default mode network.
And the default mode network, for those who might not know, is the system responsible for our autobiographical memory, our rigid daily narrative, basically our sense of self.
Your ego, essentially.
Right. So when that network goes offline, you experience ego dissolution. The boundaries between you and the environment collapse, which is where those profound entropic, highly visual hallucinations actually come from.
But here is the critical difference. The Blue Lotus does not contain tryptamines.
None at all.
None. It does not contain phenethylamines. It completely bypasses the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
Wow.
Okay. Therefore, it is mechanically impossible for the plant to dissolve the default mode network. You will not experience ego death. You will not merge with the cosmos. And you will not see the geometric visual distortions characteristic of, say, a psilocybin experience.
So if it's not hitting the serotonin psychedelic pathways, what is actually causing the psychoactivity? People are feeling something sometimes.
Right. The OTW journal identifies two primary active compounds in the plant, apomorphine and luciferine.
These are apomorphine alkaloids.
Yes, apomorphine alkaloids. And the pharmacology here is where the story gets incredibly strange, honestly. Especially starting with apomorphine.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Break down apomorphine for us.
So, apomorphine is a potent dopamine agonist. Instead of serotonin receptors, it primarily targets the D1 and D2 dopamine receptors.
Okay.
But what makes this fascinating and somewhat alarming to people encountering the research for the first time is that apomorphine is already an established, synthesized compound in modern allopathic medicine.
What is it used for?
It is primarily used as a rescue medication for advanced Parkinson's disease.
Wait, really? Let's pause on that because the leap there is massive.
It's a huge leap.
Parkinson's is a severe neurodegenerative disease. It's characterized by muscle rigidity, tremors, a loss of motor control. How does a potent pharmaceutical used to forcefully restore movement in a Parkinson's patient translate into someone sitting on their couch experiencing a floaty, euphoric dream herb state?
I know, it sounds contradictory.
The dose and the mechanism have to be radically different.
They are. It comes down to understanding the multifaceted nature of dopamine itself. We often reduce dopamine in popular science to simply the pleasure molecule.
Right, getting a dopamine hit from social media.
Exactly. But it is a vastly complex neurotransmitter that governs reward, motivation, and motor function via entirely different neural pathways.
Okay.
So in a Parkinson's patient, the neurons in the substantia nigra that produce dopamine are dying off. Their motor pathways are literally starved of dopamine.
So they can't initiate movement properly.
Right. A clinical pharmaceutical injection of apomorphine aggressively stimulates those D1 and D2 receptors to artificially replace that lost signal, which unfreezes the patient's muscles.
So it's flooding the system to overcome a severe deficit.
Precisely. It's a heavy dose for a specific mechanical failure. But now, consider a healthy individual consuming a naturally occurring, exponentially smaller dose of apomorphine derived from a flower.
They don't have that deficit.
Exactly. They don't have a dopamine deficit in their motor pathways. So instead, that subtle agonism acts primarily on the mesolimbic pathway.
The reward circuitry.
Yes, the reward circuitry. It provides a gentle stimulation that results in mild euphoria, a sensation of physical warmth, and an elevated mood.
Uh-huh, I see.
It's the difference between applying a defibrillator to a stopped heart versus giving a gentle massage to a healthy muscle.
That is a great analogy. Okay, so that covers the dopamine side, the apomorphine. But it doesn't work in isolation in the plant, right?
No, it doesn't.
The second major alkaloid is luciferine, which seems to pull the experience in a completely different direction.
It really does. Luciferine is structurally very complex, and its exact binding profile is honestly still being mapped by pharmacologists.
But we have a general idea of what it does.
Yes. Models show it modulates dopamine D2 receptors while also interacting with a variety of serotonin receptors. But crucially, not the 5-HT2A psychedelic receptor.
So it's hitting serotonin, but not the trip receptor?
Right. And in clinical observation, luciferine acts as a mild, atypical antipsychotic and a sedative.
Okay, wait. Atypical antipsychotics usually work by antagonizing or dampening overactive dopamine or serotonin pathways, right? Which creates a calming effect.
Exactly. which creates a fascinating synergy within the plant itself.
How?
You have the apomorphine, providing a gentle, warming, euphoric lift via dopamine agonism. And while that's happening, you have the luciferin simultaneously dampening certain pathways, providing a profound, dreamy, sedative calm.
What's fascinating here is the stark contrast in the architecture of the experience compared to other things people take.
Right.
Like the classic psychedelics we discussed earlier are serotonin driven. They are about radical perceptual transformation, breaking down the ego, confronting the subconscious. It's hard work.
I can be very intense.
But the Blue Lotus is dopamine driven. It operates on the reward, motivation, and relaxation circuitry. The OOTW journal describes it perfectly as a dopamine side gentleness.
Which is such a great phrase, and this is exactly why the modern conflation of the terms psychoactive and psychedelic is so detrimental.
They just aren't the same thing.
They're not synonyms at all. Caffeine is psychoactive. Nicotine is psychoactive. The state produced by Blue Lotus defies our clean, modern categorizations.
It doesn't fit in a neat little box.
No. It isn't a pure central nervous system stimulant. It isn't a heavy benzodiazepine-style sedative. And it is absolutely not a hallucinogen.
It exists in this weird liminal space.
Yeah, a subtle mood lift accompanied by vivid hypnagogic dreams and just deep, deep relaxation.
Frankly, that sounds ideal.
It sounds wonderful, doesn't it?
Yeah. A gentle, neurochemically balanced dopamine lift that relaxes you without sending you into a 12-hour existential crisis. I mean, you can easily see why the Egyptian elite revered it.
Oh, absolutely.
And why a burned-out modern consumer would seek it out today. But, you know, that brings us to the most persistent complaint about the Blue Lotus right now.
The reviews.
Yes. You go to any online forum, any wellness review site, and there are literally thousands of people saying, I bought it, I brewed it, I drank it, and I felt absolutely nothing. It's a total scam.
Right.
If the pharmacology is real, and we just establish that it is, why is the modern experience so consistently hollow for people?
Well, the discrepancy between the ancient historical record and modern disappointment is not a failure of the plant.
What is it then?
It is a failure of the modern supply chain. The OOTW journal details a major scientific intervention that happened recently to address this exact phenomenon.
Right, the 2025 study. We move from the theoretical chemistry of the brain to the deeply unregulated, messy reality of e-commerce.
It gets really messy.
So in 2025, Liam McAvoy, a researcher affiliated with the UC Berkeley Center for the Science of Psychedelics, decided to empirically test the market.
He wanted to see what people were actually consuming.
Exactly. He utilized mass spectrometry to analyze what consumers were actually buying online. And mass spectrometry, essentially, it vaporizes a sample, ionizes the molecules, and measures their mass-to-charge ratio.
It's the gold standard.
Right. It gives you an irrefutable chemical fingerprint of the exact compounds present in a substance. You cannot hide behind marketing copy when you're subjected to a mass spec.
No. It provides the molecular truth.
So McAvoy needed a baseline first. He sourced authentic, genetically verified Nymphaea caerulea directly from the UC Botanical Garden.
He had to know what the real thing looked like chemically.
Right. And then he purchased dozens of samples of dried Blue Lotus from popular online vendors. We're talking places like Etsy, specialized apothecary sites, bulk herbal suppliers.
And the results of that 2025 study completely validated the consumers who were complaining about feeling nothing.
It proved them right.
It did. The authentic botanical garden samples showed high pharmacologically active levels of both apomorphine and luciferin, just as expected.
But the online commercial samples.
The mass spectrometry revealed that a staggering majority of them contained almost none of the target alkaloids.
None? How is that possible?
Because they weren't the right plant.
Oh, wow.
The study revealed a rampant issue of botanical misidentification. And it's driven almost entirely by the economics of the supply chain.
Of course it is.
See, authentic Nymphaea caerulea from the Nile region is relatively rare today. It requires specific, labor-intensive cultivation.
Okay.
However, there are numerous other blue water lilies, like Nymphaea nuchali, the star lotus of Asia, that are visually almost identical when they're dried and chopped up.
But I'm guessing they're much easier to grow.
Incredibly cheap to grow at an industrial scale. And crucially, they contain virtually zero psychoactive alkaloids.
So the suppliers are just harvesting massive quantities of inactive, visually similar lilies, slapping a picture of a pharaoh on the bag and selling it at a massive markup.
Exactly. It's essentially counterfeit botanicals.
Imagine the frustration. You read the historical accounts, you buy the dried flowers online, you set the mood, you prepare for this profound, dream-enhancing meditation, and you are literally just drinking a cup of hot, inert pond water.
It's like ordering a rare, ancient vintage wine and finding out you were shipped a bottle of blue food coloring and tap water.
That's exactly what it's like.
And it highlights a severe vulnerability in the unregulated wellness market. Dietary supplements and dried botanicals do not undergo FDA verification for efficacy or purity before they hit the market.
The honor system.
Pretty much. The vendor is responsible for their own supply chain. And in a market driven by margins, it is far easier to sell the myth than to source the authentic botanical.
But the Berkeley study uncovered a second, even more damning reality, didn't it?
Yes, the preparation method.
Right. Let's say you navigate the fake market perfectly. Let's say you miraculously find a vendor selling genuine, verified Nymphaea caerulea. Even then, the standard modern method of consumption practically guarantees failure.
The teabag phenomenon.
Yes, the teabag phenomenon. The dominant method of consumption today is just steeping the dried petals in boiling water for 10 minutes.
Which goes right back to our earlier discussion on the absolute brilliance of ancient Egyptian pharmacology.
Right, because of solubility.
Yes. Apomorphine and luciferine are alkaloid bases. They have very, very poor aqueous solubility.
They hate water.
They do not dissolve well in water, especially when they're locked inside a dried cellular plant matrix.
So boiling water doesn't pull them out.
Boiling water might extract a tiny, tiny fraction of the compounds, but the vast majority of the active medicine remains trapped in the wet plant material.
The material that the consumer eventually just throws in the trash. Which makes the ancient Egyptian method look incredibly advanced. I mean, 3,000 years ago, without mass spectrometry, without any understanding of molecular weight or solvent polarity, they empirically deduced that water was an inefficient vector.
They just watched and learned.
Yeah, they bypassed water entirely, moving straight to lipid extractions with oils and alcohol extractions with wine.
It is a stunning example of how empirical observation over centuries can perfectly align with modern chemistry. They observed the effects, they adjusted their variables, and they found the optimal solvent.
And today?
Today, we assume that because we can order a product on our smartphones, we are utilizing the most advanced method available. We arrogantly reduce a complex pharmacological process to a convenient silk tea bag, and then we blame the plant when it doesn't work.
So if you've bought dried blue lotus online and felt nothing, you aren't immune to its effects, and the ancient legends aren't fabricated.
Not at all.
You either bought a completely different species of lily, or you failed to extract the alkaloids because you used water. The plant works. The modern commercial application of it is deeply, deeply flawed.
But, you know, an inert cup of tea is merely a financial loss. You waste $20 and move on with your life.
Right. Nobody gets hurt.
But the OOTW Journal investigation takes a much sharper, far more alarming turn when it examines a different sector of the modern market.
The vapes.
Yes. When we transition from dried flowers to concentrated vape products, we move from ineffective placebo to acute biological danger.
This is where the story shifts from a quirky botanical deep dive into a really serious public health issue.
It's extremely concerning.
The demand for Blue Lotus has spawned this massive market for e-liquids, vape cartridges, highly concentrated tinctures, and the packaging promises a potent instant extraction of the Egyptian dream flower.
But remember, true extraction is expensive and yields a very subtle effect.
Right. So the investigation found that vendors, knowing this, are actively adulterating these vape liquids to guarantee the customer feels a strong high.
And they are adulterating them with synthetic cannabinoids.
Okay. For context, synthetic cannabinoids are not simply concentrated THC or like stronger marijuana.
Not even close.
They are a completely different class of chemicals.
They are highly potent, incredibly unpredictable research chemicals. They were originally designed in laboratories. Simply to study the endocannabinoid system, compounds like JWHA018 or the various AB Fubinaca analogs.
Stuff that was never meant for human consumption.
Never. And the crucial mechanical difference is how they interact with the brain compared to natural cannabis.
Break that down for us.
Okay, so natural THC from cannabis is a partial agonist at the CB1 receptor in your brain. It binds to the receptor, but it only activates it partially.
So it can only do so much.
Right. It provides a natural ceiling to the effect.
A built-in safety valve, essentially.
Exactly. Synthetic cannabinoids, however, are full agonists, meaning they bind to the CB1 receptor with massive affinity, and they activate it to 100% capacity.
Wow.
There is no biological ceiling. It's basically like slamming the gas pedal to the floor with no brakes.
That sounds terrifying.
It is. This extreme overstimulation of the endocannabinoid system can lead to severe physiological crises. Massive spikes in heart rate, extreme paranoia, visual and auditory hallucinations, seizures, and drug-induced psychosis.
And vendors are quietly spraying these synthetic lab chemicals into vapes branded with peaceful lotus flowers and Egyptian gods.
It's incredibly deceptive.
A consumer, maybe a teenager, or just someone looking for a natural alternative to sleeping pills, they take a hit of what they believe is a gentle, natural plant. And suddenly they are hit with a massive, terrifying synthetic high.
And the worst part is, they attribute the extreme effects to the power of the ancient lotus. They are completely unaware they just inhaled an unregulated research chemical. This raises an important question, doesn't it? Why do we blindly trust the aesthetic of natural wellness? It is deeply predatory. They exploit the implicit trust consumers have for ancient natural branding to deliver a cheap, highly addictive synthetic high.
And the fallout from this specific adulteration has actually been severe enough to trigger federal action from some pretty unexpected agencies.
The Department of Defense.
Yes, the United States Department of Defense had to intervene specifically because of these laced Blue Lotus vapes.
Which is wild.
They officially placed Blue Lotus on the prohibited dietary supplement list. They issued a blanket ban for all U.S. service members. If a soldier is caught possessing or consuming a Blue Lotus product today, they are in direct violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Which creates a really tragic historical irony, if you think about it.
How so?
Well, a plant that was the supreme spiritual sacrament for the warriors and pharaohs of the ancient world is now completely criminalized for the modern military.
Wow.
Not because the plant itself is dangerous, but because the modern supply chain poisoned it with synthetic lab chemicals.
And the mechanics of how soldiers were getting caught is fascinating, too, because standard military drug testing panels, they do not screen for abamorphine or luciferine.
No, they wouldn't have any reason to.
Right, so if a soldier somehow found pure, authentic Blue Lotus, it wouldn't trigger a failure on a basic year analysis.
But the synthetic cannabinoids do.
Exactly. Those specialized panels, especially when utilizing gas chromatography mass spectrometry for confirmations, they do screen for the metabolites of synthetic cannabinoids.
That is the trap right there.
Right. A service member buys a legally available, natural-looking vape from a local shop off-base to help them sleep. They take a few hits, and the next week they fail a command-directed drug test for synthetic narcotics.
They literally face a court-martial because of a counterfeit supplement.
This really highlights the chaotic legal gray area surrounding the plant right now. Because federally, in the United States, Blue Lotus is completely unscheduled by the FDA.
It is not a controlled substance at the federal level.
Well, you can grow it, buy it, and possess it legally in almost every state. The glaring exception is Louisiana.
Right. Louisiana specifically outlawed it.
But they did it in response to the synthetic cannabinoid epidemic, basically lumping the natural plant in with the synthetic adulterants.
And internationally, the laws are just a patchwork. Countries like Russia and Poland have strictly scheduled and banned it, treating it as a dangerous narcotic, while other nations just ignore it entirely.
This fragmented regulatory environment leaves the consumer completely vulnerable. I mean, when a compound is unscheduled but widely sought after, it creates a black market in plain sight.
Exactly. There is no quality control, no standardization of dosing.
And most concerningly, no required safety warnings regarding its actual pharmacological profile.
Which is a huge problem.
Let's talk about that safety profile for a minute. Let's assume a best case scenario. A consumer manages to avoid the fake ECT. They avoid the synthetic cannabinoid vapes.
Okay, they get the real deal.
Yeah, they source genetically verified Nymphaea caerulea, and they perform a proper lipid and alcohol extraction at home. Even with the pure, authentic plant, the OOTW journal stresses a massive vacuum of clinical data.
There are zero human clinical trials evaluating the safety of Blue Lotus.
Zero.
I firmly believe we must dismantle the fallacy that natural equates to safe.
Cyanide is natural?
Cyanide is natural. It will still kill you. We know the mechanisms of apomorphine and luciferine. We know they actively modulate the dopamine and serotonin systems.
Right.
Introducing those compounds into a modern biological environment, which is often already heavily medicated, carries genuine serious risk.
Right, the polypharmacy issue. Think about the average modern consumer seeking out a dream herb. They might be dealing with insomnia, anxiety, depression.
Very common reasons to seek it out.
So let's say someone is currently taking a daily SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, to manage their depression. Their serotonin system is already being artificially stabilized by a powerful pharmaceutical.
Right.
What is the biological risk of introducing nuciferine, a known serotonin modulator, into that heavily managed environment?
The risk is profound unpredictability. While nuciferine doesn't act as a classic psychedelic, its modulation of serotonin receptors, when combined with an SSRI, could potentially contribute to overstimulation of the serotonergic system.
Which can lead to serotonin syndrome.
Exactly, which is very dangerous. And on the dopamine side, the risks are even more clearly defined.
Because of the epimorphine.
Right. Epimorphine, at pharmacological doses, has well-documented side effects. Can induce severe nausea, dizziness, and sudden drastic drops in blood pressure.
Orthostatic hypotension. Yeah. So if someone decides to mix their potent blue lotus extraction with a central nervous system depressant, say they take it alongside a heavy dose of alcohol, or they mix it with a prescription sleep aid like Ambien, or an anti-anxiety benzodiazepine.
That is a terrible idea.
They are stacking a dopamine agonist and a sedative on top of heavy respiratory depressants.
Which can lead to synergistic toxicity. You run the risk of acute hypotensive crises where your blood pressure drops to dangerous levels or significant respiratory depression.
And we just don't have the data to tell people what a safe limit is.
We simply do not have the clinical data to establish a safe dosage curve. Nor do we fully understand the pharmacokinetic half-life of these alkaloids when consumed via modern delivery methods. We are operating entirely in the dark.
So what does this all mean? The OOTW Journal investigation paints an incredibly complex picture. I mean, we started on the banks of the ancient Nile, looking at a flower that mirrored the sun and the soul's rebirth.
A beautiful symbol.
We moved into the structural pharmacology, discovering that it isn't a classic serotonin psychedelic, but rather this unique combination of a Parkinson's drug and a mild sedative acting on the dopamine reward pathways.
That dopamine side gentleness.
Right. Then we uncovered the mass spectrometry data, proving the commercial market is flooded with visually similar, biologically inert fakes.
The pondweed.
The pondweed. And that even the real plant is completely neutered by the modern teabag. And finally, we navigated the genuine hazards of vapes laced with synthetic cannabinoids and the severe biological risks of mixing these ancient alkaloids with modern pharmaceuticals.
It is a profound case study in how modern commercialization can entirely strip the context, the efficacy, and the safety away from an ancient botanical.
It really is. The blue lotus is a historically profound plant with a very real, very gentle pharmacological action, but it is currently trapped in a deeply cynical market.
It's a shame.
The label on the vape cartridge is absolutely worth doubting. The marketing copy calling it an ancient psychedelic trip is definitively false. But the plant itself and the ancient legend surrounding it remains fascinating.
Absolutely. And, you know, we must reiterate that examining this historical and chemical data is purely an exercise in education.
Oh, for sure.
This deep dive is not medical advice, and it is certainly not an endorsement to go navigate this unregulated market. The lack of clinical trials and the prevalence of severe adulterants mean that extreme, rigorous discernment is mandatory.
We spend so much time today operating under the assumption that our modern world, with our advanced laboratories, our sleek branding, and our frictionless e-commerce, has perfected human health.
We think we know everything.
We really do. We look back at ancient civilizations and assume their medicine was just superstition and guesswork. We arrogantly reduce their complex sacred sacraments into convenient little disposable vapes and silk tea bags, assuming we've improved upon the design.
But we haven't.
No, because 3,000 years ago, without the benefit of mass spectrometry, without an understanding of cellular matrices, without any formal chemical patents, the ancient Egyptians observed the biological reality of the blue lotus.
They paid attention.
They deduced that the active alkaloids were not water-soluble. They bypassed the obvious method of boiling water entirely, inventing a highly complex, chemically sound lipid-to-alcohol extraction process to unlock the true potential of the plant.
It's incredible.
It really makes you wonder, What else did the ancients perfectly understand about the intricate chemistry of the natural world that our modern, hyper-commercialized society has completely forgotten?
It is a deeply humbling thought and a reminder that true scientific curiosity requires us to question not just ancient myths, but the modern conveniences we take for granted.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Egyptian dream of flour. Keep questioning the labels, keep looking deeper, and we'll see you next time.